As we approach the end of 2023, we've created an amazing gift for you. This episode is one of the first in a series of special segments from some of our episodes about the topics of career, parenting, and spirituality. The purpose of this podcast from the beginning has always been to bring you the wisdom of mentors to be able to help you learn from their journeys and their mindset and their perspectives and their purpose to be able to create a better life for yourself. So this series is yet another tool for you in that exact same direction. So get ready, listen in, take some notes, and identify for yourself what do you want to change in your life in order to make your life even better for you. Let's begin. Here's Michael Ray from episode 6. It's fascinating what you're sharing because I struggle to believe that you've instilled this in Charlie just by telling her and being intentional about telling her all the time. It sounds like you've really put in the effort to show her as well.
Yeah, Harry, I had an aha moment one day when Charlie said to me, "Dad, I wish I wasn't scared of anything and could do everything like you." Mm-hmm. And it made me realize that, gee, I thought my dad was superhuman as well when we grew up. You know, I lost a brother in a car accident. I saw Dad shepherd the whole family through that. And it's not until now that I realize how broken he was, but held it together. And I wish he didn't. And that's why now I say to my bub, "I'm going to have a cry. It's going to be a happy cry." And she's like, "Oh, Dad, not again." So, you know, she gets an award at school and I'm the one whistling and yelling out, "Bub, I'm crying again." And I want her to know that it's normal and it's natural. And it's very easy for us dads to, you know, assume the persona of the Iron Man, the superheroic, the stoic, staunch superhero. And that actually can make our children doubt themselves when they have these feelings and go, "Oh, you know, Dad never did it." Well, so I make a point of, you know, expressing it all the time. And that's why I say to Charlie, "Oh, I'm scared. I'm scared of a lot of things. I'm, you know, scared of you getting sick. I'm scared of me not being able to earn enough money to pay for things. I'm scared of all of these things come into it." But we go on anyway. We don't live in fear. We live in purpose. So these are the reasons why I act, is to avoid some of these things, and other things I just do regardless.
How many times have you found that it's that for a lot of men, it's as a result of their relationship? There's an expectation on them from their spouse or from their wife that they're supposed to be that strong, invincible. And so it's no longer just society telling them, it's also their spouse expecting it of them as their role of a father of their child. How often do you find that?
Harry, a lot. Society, men are struggling, Harry, at the moment. And I work in the equality space. And as I mentioned before we got on, I don't like the terms women's rights, gay rights, trans rights, religious freedoms, all of those things. They're human rights and human freedoms. We all have an inalienable and well-deserved right to be respected for exactly who we are. As long as we're not doing harm to others, everyone should have the same thing. Men seem to have been overlooked in this march towards a new contemporary society because it's always been assumed that men have been all right. We have 7 men per day dying from suicide in Australia. Wow. It's the largest cause of death for 18 to 44-year-old men. Now, if we had 7 whales a day washing up on Bondi Beach, the worldwide outcry would be huge. But for some reason, it's not there. And then we get, well, men don't speak, men don't interact with the services. Well, to me, that's victim blaming. That's no different than, you know, what was she wearing when she got attacked, or what was she wearing? How drunk was she? None of that matters. And if men aren't engaging with the services that are meant to help them, the services need to be redesigned. Because to me, that's the equivalent of the comedian going, "Well, that crowd's terrible. They didn't laugh at my jokes and I'm funny." Well, no, the services need to be fixed. So we've got men who still get teased. They're still, "Oh, man flu." Really? 7 men a day taking their own lives, and you want to minimize their illness or try and dissuade them from going, "Oh, I'm a bit sick," by teasing them about it. You know, it's just man flu. It's just not acceptable. And, you know, men are struggling, and just because they don't speak up doesn't mean that it's not happening. It means that they've been conditioned into that fear-based thing where I won't do it until they take the saddest path of all. So, you know, we often hear about the mental load that women suffer and the discrimination that women suffer, and they do, 100%. But there's a concurrent version of the male. It's the same coin, the opposite side of the outdated gender expectation. You know, even the thing where they say men need to speak up, well, you know, so do women. And the reason men don't speak up is often exactly the same as women. So there's a power imbalance. Somebody says something inappropriate to a woman at a pub. The man speaks up, the man gets bashed. Happens all the time. Men are more likely to be the victim of violent assault than women. Happens at work. Somebody says something inappropriate, a boss or the power imbalance. Women say they don't want to speak up because they're in fear of losing their job. It's no different to their co-worker who's a male. Imagine that. Well, go home. Honey, I lost my job today, but I did the right thing. When the boss said something inappropriate to Sally, I told him that was not on and he sacked me. It's the exact same thing. This is where the true equality comes in. Trying to promote the outdated gender stereotype of men as the protectors and the heroes, not all of us are like that. I came from the thing as a bodyguard. I don't have a problem doing it, but many men do, and that doesn't make them less of a man, until we realise, hey, we're all the same puppy with a different tail. Man, woman, transgender, all the rest of it. We're all insecure, wanting to fit in, trying to do our best and worried about being judged. Once you throw that judgment out, once you go, you know what, I am who I am, and, you know, that's what I say, I'm often the target of outdated gender stereotypes and expectations, but that's about them. What I will never be is the victim of it. Because that's on me. So do your best, throw your judgment, throw your stigmas. That says everything about you and nothing about me.
Here's Ben McAvoy from episode 7.
You know, to me, it's really about how do I demonstrate through my actions, you know, particularly to my family and my two kids, about what a life well lived. And yeah, that sounds a little bit woo-woo as well, but I think that's what gets me up and gets me going every day, whether it's exercising to stay healthy, going to work to demonstrate the importance and the value that I place in just hard work. Because I think there's a lot of value in just, what's the saying, chop wood and carry water? I haven't
heard that saying before.
I think it's like it's a Buddhist saying or something, but it's just like there's so much gold in just learning how to chop wood and carry water. Mm. Just learning the discipline of hard work and perseverance is really important. So they're the things that they're my why now, of living a life and demonstrating to my kids and to my family and the people that I love that they're the things that you need to do to live a life of being happy, strong and healthy. So again, it sounds very like journey orientated, but I think that's just where my head is at the moment.
So what are all the things that you're doing now to be the best example of a life well lived to your kids?
I think the best thing I ever figured out was that to remind my kids every day to not to do what I do, not what I say. Because it's almost like extreme accountability. Yeah, so I'd recommend anyone with kids to get your kids to hold up a mirror to you every single day, because, gee, they're good at it.
Can you give a specific example?
Just like, you know, get off the screen. Yeah, but Dad, you're on your phone. Yeah, and then you go, I've got this very important work email, and I've got this. Like, no, you don't. Like, put your phone down. Like, so just like a really simple example like that, or like, you know, or, you know, just, you know, try. I've got two girls who love reading. Right. And I'm always like, oh, you should get outside. Let's go to the park. Let's go and walk the dog. And they're like, you know, but they're like, oh, yeah, no, whatever. Like, yeah, they're enjoying reading their book or whatever, and that's great. But they're not going to get a love for the outdoors unless I show them a love of the outdoors. So I just think it's just those really little things of just holding yourself accountable every day to so that they can do what you do, not do what you say.
I love that. Do as I do, not as I say. It's the complete opposite of every example of parenting you can find.
But it's so freaky because you realize like how many contradictions you walk around with.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you, especially, you know, my eldest is 9, like it realizes how incongruent you can be. Yeah, like I was saying before, it's so easy to trick yourself into thinking that you're doing all the right things, and there's no one more honest, I don't think, about how you're behaving than your kids. They're just brutal.
Here's Nathan Barantakiri from episode 10. How's this changed your parenting style?
I'm a very, very conscious, intentional dad. You know, partly because, and I've got a few friends who've kind of walked a similar journey to me. When you know what a great dad isn't, because that's what you've experienced firsthand, you basically just take the opposite of that and you've got a pretty good list of the kind of dad you want to be. It's actually highly effective. Right. And then when you've got a great mum, it kind of, you know, there's someone who can fill in the gaps. But I've been very intentional about, you know, how is it that people learn, adapt? You know, how do they experience fear? How do they use their fear? Do they run away from it? You know, I've walked that journey. I still do, like all of us. But when I do, I really try and learn from it. And when I learn from it, I really look at how can I teach others what it is that I've learned. So my kids have always had that for me. Really good example is, you know, public speaking, one of those horrible things that most people hate. I was, as kind of, you know, fate would have it, I was always pushed into doing that from a really young age. And I remember kind of hating it, but you just kind of got better at it. You got good at it. And consequently, it's part of my toolkit. And so whenever there's a moment where people gather and we need to mark time with some words, someone should do it. Why not me? And so I've brought them up that way. And recently they both were freaked out about their speech competitions at school, like physical fear and sickness, you know. I think we've all experienced a bit of that at some point in our lives. And we went through a process of understanding the value of it, the power of speaking, and then the process of creating a speech, and then being able to kind of learn how to perform it. And I was so proud of them. They both delivered it. They did an incredible job. And they both made their speech finals, and my daughter went on to like inter school finals and stuff. This is a kid that was too freaked out to do a speech at all, let alone be the person to differentiate themselves. And, you know, that's the kind of intent, I think, that if we can afford the time, and I think we should all try and afford that time, that's what shapes our kids. That's the formational, foundational stuff. And I've always been like that. What's changed? To kind of specifically answer your question, they've seen a bit of a shift in me. They've seen me share my story, a version of what we've been talking about, many times with different people here at our house over the last year or so. And every time, they'll be with their friends, they'll be doing something, there'll be a lot of noise around or what have you, and I'll catch them, they'll be stopped, just very quiet, very attentive, very, very keyed into what it is that I'm talking about and they're thinking. And I can see, you know, they know what's most important to me and to this family. That stuff gets in, you know, that's a value system that I think they already have. They're already talking about things like, you know, my son wants to be in the NBA. He's a great basketball player, but he wants to be in the NBA. We've talked about backup plans because, you know, not that many people are going to make it into the NBA, right? So, you know, about 6 months ago, I was driving along in the car and you know, we were driving somewhere and he was looking kind of thoughtful and he looks at me in the rearview mirror and he's like, Dad, if I don't get an MBA, can I come and work for you? And one day, do you think I might be able to run that company? And I was blown away because on the one hand, he's got this dream of being a professional basketball player. And on the other, he's really considering what might his kind of contribution to the world be, and how can he align it, how can he hitch into our family wagon. You know, I was blown away, and my daughter has said similar things. So I think what it means is we do have far more considered conversations, quite specific conversations about other people and about the state they might be in and what it is that we've got in our power to be able to do to help them. Look, if you start hearing those things at the age of 8 or 9 or 10, where does that lead you over the next 30, 40 years? When you realize that those are the things that your parents tell you are the most important things in life. I've got a pretty good guess as to where it leads you, but time will tell.
Here's Will Zhang, episode 12. How did you manage your role as a father versus this role of trying to make sure that the business is doing really well? Because it must have felt great. You're like, yeah, my team's growing. We've now got 60 staff. We've now got 70 staff, and it's amazing. And look at how much we're growing. It must be great. But I'm sure that there were a lot of hours which were being put into the office, and that would have been at the expense of home, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And put it simply, you know, the father role was not designed at, you know, during that period. Yeah. So there's very little time other than the weekends. One thing I have been proud of myself is I don't spend too much time over the weekends on work. It doesn't matter how busy I am. Even during those period, I still managed not to get myself onto the business during the weekend, just focus on family a little bit. But during the weekdays, yeah, there's lots of late nights, 8, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, sometimes 12. I rarely have dinner with families. I still kind of don't have too many dinner nights still nowadays, but I can see that things are slightly getting better and better now.
Here's Damon Burden from episode 13.
So I grew up, like I said, my parents got divorced when I was 2. Then my mom remarried a second gentleman. He was pretty chill. But the third guy, he was an alcoholic. They were married for 20 something years, very toxic environment. And so from that, I learned how not to raise a family. And so it's like, those are the things I don't want to expose my kids to on a consistent basis, are those toxic things. And that's why I bought the house to grow into, to provide that stability. Cause those are all the things that when I was a kid, I didn't know any different, and I don't have like this traumatic childhood. Well, my childhood was interesting because to me, it wasn't traumatic. I learned from it. And I think it's like there's like a cliche story where it's something like there was two brothers, and one was an alcoholic and homeless, and the other was successful. And somebody went to the first brother and said, "Why are you an alcoholic?" And his response is, "Well, because my father was an alcoholic." And then they went to the successful gentleman and they said, "Why are you successful?" He says, "Well, because my father was an alcoholic." And that's very applicable to me, because I learned from that toxic environment of the alcoholic stepfather. And then I learned from the victim mindset that my mom had, and never looking for a path out of that, you know? And so for me, it was like, okay, those are the things that I don't want. I don't want to move 2-3 times a year for my kids. I don't want financial instability. And so those are all the things that now I'm very intentional. By now, hopefully, like, intention is very clear with me, right? And so in all capacities of my life, be intentional with the direction of the company, be intentional with the opportunities I want to give my kids, be intentional for giving them a better childhood than I had, but without turning them into spoiled shitheads. And so it's like, how do I find all those balances of everything? And it's just all about, so it's all intentional. And so because of that, I can separate the circumstances of, like, the example you gave of how do you tell somebody something and they don't take action on it, versus how do you tell a 10-year-old and they don't take action on it? So, you know, certainly in the back of my mind, it's like, ah, come on, just do it. But then right aside with that is, well, he's a 10-year-old. So let him be a 10-year-old.
So how do you present it? Like, how do you find that balance that you're referring to?
I don't push my, I try to find the balance of, encouraging independence without pushing my excessive intention. Like, you know, I'm very intentional and strategic about things, and I understand the value and the benefits of that, but I also understand the weaknesses and the OCD and, you know, the constant thoughts and things like that. And so I try to show all the positive opportunities and characteristics from the things that I've learned while just exposing them to it, not requiring it of them, but exposing them to things. Like, maybe an easier way to explain it is just like sports. So I don't require my kids to do any sports, but I expose them to all of them. So they, at least for a season, they all play basketball. They all play baseball. They, you know, play soccer. And then if they don't like it, they have to at least try it. But if they don't like it, then that's totally fine. You know, my one kid, my 10-year-old, he tried wrestling. He went like 3 times and he's like, this is definitely not for me. That's fine. You know, I don't want my kids to have to live through, like, I think a lot of parents force their kids to, they try to live their dreams through their kids. And I don't try to force my kids to do anything. I just want them to be happy and confident in whatever it is that they do. And so I try to expose them to all these different things so they can hopefully find, you know, we talked about dating things and marrying things. I'm fortunate enough that I want to try to expose them to different opportunities so they can find the things that they like and don't like to date, so that ultimately they can find their own path in life. I don't want to push them down a path, but I want to help them find it on their own.
So do you push them to try things?
I expose them to things, and if I know it's not a definite no, then I'll try to encourage them to at least try it one time, yeah. I mean, there's some things that are just clearly obvious, like my kids have zero interest in football. Not, you know, American football. But they absolutely love soccer. And so there's certain opportunities that are no-brainers. My 10-year-old is super active, and he's like at a level 10 energy until the last blink of an eye at night. And then my 7-year-old is the total opposite. He's the most innocent, soft-hearted kid you'll ever meet. And when it's 8:30, he'll tell you, I'm tired and I want to go lay down. Meanwhile, his brothers want to stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning, even though he can barely keep his eyes open. So it's like they're all different. And then, you know, my daughter's 4. And so she's kind of a, depending on the day, she's kind of a mix between the two of them. And so they're all separate human beings. And so I don't force them all to try all the same things, but I try to identify what their strengths are and the things that make them happy, and then expose them to the things that I think that can continue that path to happiness.
Here's Vin Jang, episode 15.
The thing I think about with my son, Xander, is that I let him climb the monkey bars. I let him go onto the top of it. You know, I let him do all of those things. And I think sometimes other parents might look at me and go, oh my goodness, why is he letting his son do all of these things? Well, to me, it's that he has to learn how to fall. I'm not always going to be there to catch him. He has to learn that this is dangerous. He has to learn some of it. I mean, you know, I'm not going to let him play with a knife and play stabby, but it's just like, I'm going to let him try these things. I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to try to protect him from everything, because I want him to grow to be strong, not to be safe. I'm building a life now with my family, not building a life for my family.
Yes.
And that's probably the biggest takeaway that I had, is it's, hey, let's build a life together. You know, whereas before I was making all of these decisions and I never took into consideration what my wife was thinking, what my son was thinking, you know, whereas now I feel way more like we're building a life together, you know, with my family, not for my family. Whereas you asked me even 3 years ago, everything I did was for my family. And I was very self-sacrificial. I was like a martyr. I was proud of it. I wore it like a badge of honor. Oh, I'll sacrifice this for you. I don't want to sacrifice anything for family. I don't want to use that language. I don't want that language to be the language my son hears, because that was the big language my parents used with me a lot. Is, you know, I sacrifice this for you. We sacrifice that for you. I don't want my son to feel like I've sacrificed my life for him. No, I want him to. I'm happily doing it because I'm going to win along the way too. I'm not, you know, I want to be conscious of not giving my own happiness up. like so quickly, like that being the first thing we do. It's like the first thing we do is we've got to give up dad's happiness. You know, it's like, oh, well, do we really have to? Can we do both? Yeah.
And it's as if you learned that from your own childhood, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I see it a lot in my community. The common one Asian parents will say is, you know, I've sacrificed my health, my back, my youth, you know, for you. And then it becomes such a heavy weight, right? Whereas I don't want that weight. I don't want my son to have that weight, I think.
How did you let go of that weight yourself?
I don't think I have. Mm-hmm. I think I'm still hanging on to that. I think that that kind of impact is still playing out. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I'd imagine that some people who are listening to this are thinking, yeah, great. It's all fine and well that you can now say that you're doing life with your family and you're working with your family rather than working for them. But those 3 or 4 years of you working your ass off and sacrificing yourself would have improved your career and just would have created even more momentum.
Definitely.
And if you had the perspective you have now, then you probably would have grown your brand and grown your career slower than you otherwise would have.
That's true.
And what's your response to that? Or maybe I'll ask it another way. If you go back to 3 or 4 years ago and you were to speak to yourself when you saw yourself sacrificing everything for your family, would you have tried to change your mind?
I don't think so. Okay. Because just like you said, it's... Well, I think I now realize that there are chapters in life. Your life is like a book and there are chapters. And there are chapters when you do have to be a Formula One race car and pedal to the metal. There are chapters where that is necessary. I probably wouldn't have changed what I did. I probably would have changed how I did it. I would have communicated it to my wife with more clarity that this is just a chapter of our lives. And there is a point where this chapter will move into the next. And I probably wouldn't have kept that chapter as long as I did. I didn't need to do that for 4 years. I probably only needed to do it realistically for 2.
Here's Ben Selkeld from episode 17.
But coming back to pre-kids, like we had a pretty intense journey to fall pregnant and have children. And one of the big things that really awakened me to fatherhood was, you know, when we're looking down the line of adopting children. And I really struggled with it at the time because where I was in terms of my modality, I'm thinking, hey man, it's got to be my sperm or it's not my kid. I don't mean to get crass on here, but it was like, that was my line of thinking. And I had to challenge myself on it and really look into it. What is fatherhood? What does it mean to be a father? It has nothing to do with genetics. And that's when I started to have my epiphany. And I remember the day, man, and this sounds pretty cuckoo and crazy, but as we were trying to fall pregnant, I'm out in the surf. I had this epiphany moment that fatherhood has nothing to do with genetics and it's all about how I mentor and show up for a soul that decides to come into this earth or come into under my mentorship. Within, you know, that period, within a couple of weeks, you know, we fell pregnant with our firstborn, Bodhi.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely changed my life, man.
You've mentioned, though, when you started talking about mentorship, that it was also fatherhood. Like you mentioned the two in pretty much the same sentence. And so how do you see the difference, or if there are any differences, between mentoring and fathering?
The big difference, I guess, between mentoring men and fathering children is children don't have the worldly experience that a middle-aged man does. You know, there's still learning. There's a lot of gaps in their wisdom. And so it's really being able to challenge myself and remind myself when I'm around the children that they're not a 30-year-old adult. They're an 8-year-old child. I think there's a balance though. Like I'll still, you know, communicate with them at a pretty high level. Like I don't feel the need to sort of drop down to a where we think, you know, like kid talk, like more adult level talk, like outside their stretching them into their growth zone, so to speak. But that's probably the biggest difference around mentoring a grown man and mentoring a child. Is also too, you're being, you know, the practice of being more patient with children. Mm. You know, that's a big practice of mine. How do I find more patience in the moment? Reminding myself, is, you know, Bodhi, he's 11 years old. He wants to challenge right now. He wants to see what he can get away with, and that's okay. And I don't want to strip that away from him, because I don't want him to just conform when anyone tells him what to do. And same with my daughter, like, you don't want them to just grow up saying yes to however they're being told and treated. You want them to step up for themselves, speak up for themselves. So it's really navigating that space. How do I create enough space that they can grow and challenge, but also to create the right type of boundaries that they don't go too far and beyond, and realize that I'm doing it out of the practice of unconditional love for these children.
Here's Martin Hume Cobb, episode 19.
That was a beautiful time. That was such a fun time when my sons were really young. And then because my sons are a bit like Diane and I, they're very creative. They didn't like school. They didn't enjoy school. And the schools available in the area where we lived weren't, none of them sort of really aligned with what we felt would work for them. We ended up taking our kids out of school, and we actually homeschooled our three sons from right up through high school, along with sort of running this design company, which we ran for the next, must have been 20 years, probably 15, 20 years. I can't remember exactly.
How did you make that decision to, because there's three boys,
yeah,
and like that could be a very chaotic household. And most people are very excited for school because, okay, get the kids away. They can go there, and then I can really focus on what I've got to do, and then I'll give them my full attention later.
Yeah.
And you've been deciding to kind of split your attention, not in terms of hours on end between work versus family. It was throughout the whole day, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was very integrated, family and business. But that was when they were very young. How it worked is that we did send them to school. There was a local school they went to, and we could just sort of see that they were going backwards, because we'd, you know, they could read very early, and they were all really gifted at art, like Diane and I, very creatively oriented. And they just the world of school just didn't work with them. This sort of conforming sort of pedestrian sort of approach to learning. They'd already experienced this very sort of dynamic learning environment of our home, where there was high levels of creativity and so on. I think in a sense we sort of set them up to fail at school, because they'd already experienced learning as a really super fascinating, super challenging thing at home. So they weren't happy at school. And so, yeah, Diane and I hadn't enjoyed school, and we didn't want to put our kids through the experience that we really didn't enjoy ourselves. We weren't going to do that to our children. And we really encouraged them to go to university, and they all chose not to go. Mm-hmm. And they've all just chosen to have a career as musicians. Because I'd taught them music as part of the homeschooling, mm-hmm. taught them piano, and then they ended up creating a sort of rock band together, my three sons. And,
right.
And we ended up sort of touring around the world together, and them having sort of number one songs on the Australian chart and playing to crowds of, I can remember standing in the crowd at Big Day Out in Sydney, and they were playing on the main stage, singing a song that was the number one song in Australia at the time. And the whole crowd was singing the song with them, and that's just something that my sons and I did together as sort of part of us just taking education in an unconventional pathway.
It must have made you a very proud dad.
Yeah, it was it was incredible. It was just sort of a dream fulfilled. Yeah, when they were young, I could see the potential of them playing together because they all just seemed very gifted musically. And so all I did was just provide the opportunities and over time we got together the instruments and they ended up going in a competition, a high school rock band competition in New Zealand called the Rock Quest. And that was like a nationwide high school competition that was on television, sort of prime time television in New Zealand. And like 600 bands from different high schools all around New Zealand entered. And they ended up winning the whole thing and winning $10,000 first prize and getting a recording opportunity to record and various things. And off the back of that, they then decided, okay, we're just going to do music. And so they did that. We did that for the next 10 years. And that was pretty much my full-time job, was sort of helping manage that enterprise together.
Okay. So design business.
Yeah.
Then switch to band manager for your sons.
And the music business. And then, yeah.
And here's James Kirby from episode 26.
I 100% believe if you're going in with a compassionate focus, what happens then when the child is having a tantrum? And tantrum is probably not a very nice word to be using, but if the child's, you know, having a breakdown, a compassion focus puts the focus on the child.
Mm.
They are suffering. What can I do that would actually be of help with their suffering right now? Whereas the former way of thinking, it's kind of all about almost me, 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 me. How am I seen? What do people think of me? Yes, I'm making a racket here. It's, you know, my child. And then all of a sudden, the attentional focus is on you and there's this urgency to correct it immediately. But really, when a kiddo is in that kind of state out shopping, there is no quick fix.
No.
You know, and it's just like, how are you at tolerating that uncomfortability? And that becomes part of it. So part of the work that we would do is, how do you start to tolerate this and recognize that, yeah, it's super uncomfortable and no one would choose it, but you can tolerate it. And then after 10 minutes, things are settled down again and you reset. A lot of the work we do with the compassion focus is about the reset, right? Can you reset after you've experienced the pain? Can you reset and connect again in a positive way? For many, there's almost no reset or repair. It's kind of like broken down. If it's broken down, you're now in that stimulated situation yourself physiologically and threat focused. So you're regulating a threat with a threat, your own threat, and then you kind of, you know, perhaps yell or scream or threaten your kid. If you don't do this, we won't be coming. You know, we've all done that kind of stuff, which often can just amplify the difficulty or the pain. And then the judgment even becomes twofold. And now they've seen me yell at my kid. You know, that kind of part commences. And then after, it's like silence. You know, you'll go to your room when I get home, or, you know, a removal of something that was a positive in the child's life has occurred. You know, okay, you're not going to be able to play this when you get home. Something like this. And there's a separation. Whereas what we're ideally wanting is after that difficulty's occurred, and it's been painful for both parent and child, can you reconnect? Can you lay down a memory of emotional warmth here? And that will help both reconnect and crack on again.
And here's Henry Shookman from episode 27. Well, you're married and you have two boys, and so you're a father. And of course, you had a lot of challenges with your own father when you were growing up. And you've been on this journey of meditation and mindfulness and practice and rewiring your own urology, changing your inner climate. How has this transformed your ability to be a great partner and a great father? Or a better partner,
yeah,
better father?
Yeah, maybe we have to say better, yeah, I think. I mean, honestly, I think hugely, because having this practice, and, you know, because I've done a lot of therapy as well. Basically, I've been on a path of healing and awakening. You know, I'd say those two. By awakening, I mean that sort of the sort of deeper explorations of our cosmic and mm-hmm. existential situation, you know, which I think is available to us and is the coolest thing we can do, really, you know, in some ways. But doing all that has meant that I'm definitely. God, I you know, you ought to talk. Really, ought to talk to my wife about it before, you know, take all this with a pinch of salt. But on the whole, I'm less reactive, like, better at being more responsive and less reactive. In a nutshell, in other words, you know, just much more able to have a measured response than I would be otherwise. Let's say.
Okay, can we dive into that a little bit more? What would it look like if it wasn't a measured response, and what does it look like now that it is a measured response?
Well, as somebody who, you know, grew up traumatized, I've you know, had a lot of fear and doubt and defensiveness about relationships, about relating to others. I grew up very distrustful of others, and just really and cautious and anxious and scared of other people a lot of the time. I mean, and that really has changed, and it's changed gradually and in a series of kind of breakthrough moments as well, where, you know, suddenly some piece of my own programming was just clear to see, and I was able to release it, and a flood of warmth and love comes in that is then easier to express and share. You know, that's, I don't say that's only about meditation. That's a ton of therapy of different kinds have really helped me over the years. Mm-hmm. And
it's part of it, right? Because, like, I mean, I so obviously this will be cut out from what people hear. But there was a moment there where you were interrupted by one of your kids shouting, "Dad!" And I could see visibly in your facial response, there wasn't anger or frustration or annoyance or whatever it was, like, which most people would experience. Like, oh, these people should know. These people know that they shouldn't just shout. They should check if I'm busy, whatever, right? Like, I could visibly see that didn't show up on your face like it would for most people. And as a result, it was pretty clear that you responded in a very loving and caring way and just explaining the situation, as opposed to being triggered back to whatever happened in childhood anytime that you were interrupted or if you were the one interrupting your dad or whatever it was.
Right.
And so that was very clear to me. Can you think of other examples where that's showing up?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, well, it's nice for you to point that out. I mean, actually, why not leave that in? That might be quite, well, I suppose you won't if you cut out the call. But that, yes, I mean, that totally for me is very, that seems very, I mean, you know, in a nutshell, I mean, maybe this sounds a bit crass, but damn, I mean, this kind of work that I've been talking about on ourselves, I mean, it allows us to love more. Mm. In a nutshell, it makes it easier to love, to literally feel love.
Here's Rajan Shankara, episode 31.
You have to keep logic and not let emotion get after you. I mean, I think I had a really easy time the first 2 years so far with our daughter. It hasn't really been that shocking. Like, and I think it's because it's just, if you apply logic, you can kind of overcome anything that might be going on. And people freak out.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, like when people freak out when their child is freaking out. And you know, I used to work with clients in a therapy type setting. And, you know, you see parents kind of go after each other and either financial problems or the child is going crazy and they blame each other. It's all emotion. It's all getting wires crossed because there's emotion. But if you remain logical and can detach your awareness from what's going on around you, nothing has to affect you. Nothing has to affect you. And it's very challenging. I say it, but It's not easy. But it is a real thing. It's a very real thing.
Is it still a challenge for you after 12 years of being a monk? And
Oh yeah. To me, there is no, you know, mastery. There's just constant work. You know, I don't really believe in being a master and things like that. I think that you just get better at recovery times. You know, you snap back to who you were faster each time. My guru would say that. You know, there's not this aspect of perfection, but there's this sense of recovery. I think, and you know, maybe something that used to bother you for a week bothers you for a day, and then bothers you for an hour, and then bothers you for 5 minutes, and then maybe a quick thought, and then boop, a snap back to who I was before the challenge occurred.
Right.
And I love those photos of my daughter, like when she's pissed off and everyone else is smiling, trying to force her to smile because she's really pissed. I love posting those because it's like, see, like there is no smile here for her this moment. She's upset. And it's like, this is all we had. And mm-hmm. my wife hates it, but it's like, that's real.
Here's Jeffrey Wong, episode 37.
What every child, what every parent needs to know is it's not that, you know, the world's going to roll over and all of a sudden become great for your child. You know, it's going to be tough. There's going to be suffering. You know, there's going to be pain. You're going to have to, but you, the way you prepare your child to be able to grapple with that is to make them realize the inner power that they have. And part of that is leading by example. What I realized was that the reason I wasn't able to be impactful before was because I was thinking about myself. You know, when I changed the mindset that I'm doing this for my son, for the, you know, for others, the impact I had was, it was immense. You know, there was something, and maybe this is just the way I'm wired. When I'm doing it for myself, you know, and I know I'm doing it for the wrong motivations, I'm not as convincing, I'm not as convicted, I'm not as persuasive. But when I'm doing it for my child, it might be the same message, it might be the same outcome, but the impact is phenomenally different, you know. And maybe it's just the way I feel about it, but it definitely gives me great motivation, you know, like, you know, sort of, you know, I realize that I'm doing something that's far greater than myself. And that gives me, you know, I suppose it gives me the courage to actually go and do something that I'm obviously very uncomfortable with.
Here's Nick Langton, episode 46.
The advice I give now comes from the lens of being your dad and raising, you know, three boys who are now young men now. And, you know, as I say, my twins recently got their P plates, so they're now. It's the weirdest thing to see your three kids get in a car together with no parent and drive off out of the driveway. It's you have a moment to think that's my entire world in that car together now on the road. It doesn't feel that long ago that I was clipping them into baby seats. So the reason from my perspective, what sharpens it is that when I think about how you'd give advice to a friend, a loved one who came to you in need, and particularly how you'd give advice to your kids, which, you know, with your kids, you're not going to shortchange them on honesty to save their feelings if you really love them, right? Because presumably if they feel safe enough, you can tell them what you need to tell them, and you can tell them from an environment of high support, but you also don't have to sugarcoat that maybe they came up short in that regard, and you're telling them, I'm telling you the truth because I love you, right? Like that's an easy conversation to have. I think it would be helpful, and I try and do this somewhat, I think it would be helpful if the way we spoke to our friends, ourselves internally, if we were speaking with that same degree of honesty, transparency, and respect we show our kids, because they're the most precious things in the world, if you could, you know, fashion, if I could speak to myself the way, I would never... in my harsher moments when I've been angry at myself about something, my internal monologue might be really quite aggressive and self-admonishing. Yet I would never speak to one of my boys like that, because I know that'd be completely counterproductive. Right.
You're unique as a dad in that sense. Not unique, as in, unfortunately, I see a lot of parents struggle to manage their emotions, and they do speak to their kids the way they speak to themselves, as opposed to speaking to their kids the way they wish they spoke to themselves. And you've found a way to differentiate between those two. Is it just because you just value your kids and you love them so much? Or is it because you've done other elements of personal development and kind of like work on yourself? Or is there something else? Because that you said that as a blanket rule, like for everyone who loves their kids. I agree with you. I've been very proud of myself being able to act that way.
Yeah.
But I've had a lot of dads share with me, and mums as well, that they're not capable of doing it in the same way.
Yeah.
They wish they could.
I mean, look, I still have the crazy dad moments where I'll yell out at them for something that's, you know, someone's broken something, or, you know, something silly's happened after we've said, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that. But I'm talking about where I characterize it as being where I don't make the mistake is if it's actually really important life advice, or it's something that we're really got to talk about because I think it's intrinsically valuable to their personal development. I'm very conscious of the gravity of that conversation, and I want to make sure that conversation is not rushed and it's not done in a way that's too emotionally charged, and that we can that they feel safe participating in the conversation. They're not just being a good sign for parents. If your kids are sitting there and entirely passive in a conversation, just listening to you, it might be either they're bored or disengaged or they're scared, and they just want this moment to end. So I think that I'm very deliberate about saying, you know, I check back I said, you know, is what I've said, does that make sense? If it doesn't, help me understand. You know, I do ask open questions at the end to say, do you understand what I'm saying there, or have I explained that well enough? Could I, you know, I do make sure I sort of check in on that. And so, I mean, after every parent goes through their moments where they can give me, you know, I can come downstairs and, you know, after being at work all day, and let's say the boys have been on school holidays, you come home and the kitchen's a mess. I'm not going to say I want to sit down and have a really careful, gentle conversation about why they should think about their mum, and I might just yell out, guys, this is a joke. Come on. You know, and they'll come down and go, yeah, and they'll clean it up. So, but for any conversation that I think has a lot of gravity for their development, I'm very conscious of that. And I think I'm conscious of that because I've done some self-development myself. I've worked with, you know, professionals to help better understand, you know, my mind, how I approach life, how I think about life. You know, I read a bunch of books, listened to a bunch of people, understand that I'm a work in progress till the day I die, and being very comfortable with the fact that I'm a work in progress until then.
So I hope you received a whole lot of value from engaging in that conversation. What were the key takeaways for you? What can you schedule in your life right now to make sure that the time you just invested into listening to this exceptional conversation with this amazing mentor and this amazing individual is time that wasn't misused, but was time that you've allocated properly to enhancing your life and improving it? Whatever it is, schedule it now, practice it now, be the successful person you're meant to be. Live with purpose.